Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's National Foundation for American Policy Immigration press conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Stuart Anderson. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi, this is Stuart Anderson. I'm Executive Director of the National Foundation for American Policy. It's a nonpartisan public policy research group started in 2003. We focus primarily on trade and immigration, and the study we're going to be talking about today is on our website at www.nfap.com. That's nfap.com. I'm going to briefly go through the study, and then Tamar Jacoby, who's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, will make some comments, and then we'll open up for questions. Now, there's been a very spirited debate over the Senate immigration bill that passed recently, but the debate has also included a discussion of what's the numerical impact of the bill. And before getting some specifics on the numbers, I wanted to just go over make a few general points. And first is that the purpose of the bill really has been, for at least the supporters on the Senate side, was obviously aimed at trying to find a new approach on controlling illegal immigration that goes beyond just additional enforcement measures. And that's where the concept of the temporary worker program has come in as a way to reduce illegal immigration. And I guess I would say up front that based on the research that we've done, and some of that is on our website, and some of it's also included in this document, is that a temporary worker program with sufficient visas will likely do more to reduce illegal immigration than the various enforcement measures that are put in either the House or the Senate bill. Although I would have to say that when they reduced it down to 200,000 a year in the Senate bill, that's probably an insufficient number of visas for the purpose that the original sponsors were intending to help reduce illegal immigration in that way. The second area to focus on is that the numbers on legal immigration in the bill and on family immigration, I think they're aimed at trying to get at the large backlogs that exist where people are waiting 5 to 10 years for spouses or adult children to be able to join them in the United States. And similarly, on the employment side, you're looking at 5-year waits or more for green cards once someone may be in the country on a temporary visa, such as an H-1B visa. And those waits are causing people, and you're hearing these stories every day of people just leaving the country because they just feel they have no chance to participate in U.S. society and get on with their lives. And so that's aimed at the skilled portion. But I think also the increase is also aimed at accommodating the future flow of workers at the lower end of the skill spectrum as well. And then a final point before getting to the numbers, and as you'll see in the study, is that a large percentage of the people who would be considered new legal immigrants under the bill are already in the country, particularly during the first 10-year period. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that in the bill's first 10 years, 59% of new legal immigrants under S-261 would be, and I'm quoting here, individuals who are or will be in the United States under current law and would change their immigration status. Now, to quickly go through the numbers, I'm basically going to follow the format of the report and going through the categories. Overall, you'd be looking at concluded that over 20 years, the bill would lead to approximately 28.5 million net new legal immigrants immigrating to the United States. But again, many of those, as I point out, would already be in the United States and would now become counted as legal immigrants. To go through the categories, the employment-based immigrant category would go from the current 140,000 up to 450,000 for the first 10 years. And then the second 10 years, it would that would be level reduced to 290,000. But they would also be another type of increase in that they would not be counting the spouses and children as now are counted in the count of these categories. But just to make things a little more complicated, the Senator Bingaman had an amendment near the end of the bill's consideration that would cap all of that at no more than $650,000 a year, including the spouses and children that other parts of the bill say won't be counted at all. And I'll be happy to answer any questions on that aspect. Now, what's very important to note is that anyone entering new as a future H-2C temporary worker in one of these lesser skilled categories, the lesser skilled occupations, would, if they were to stay here permanently, they would come under these same employment-based immigrant caps. In addition, folks who are, and I'll go through the legalization in a second, but folks who are in unauthorized status now in this 2 to 5 year period, if they were to stay in the country and get sponsored and become a permanent resident green card holder, they also would fall under these green card numerical limits for employment based. Moving on to family sponsor, this is much simpler. Essentially, the categories now that make up the family preferences, where you're looking at a U.S. citizen being able to sponsor a sibling, an adult child, an unmarried child, and a permanent resident being able to sponsor a spouse or minor child or adult child. These preferences are now $226,000, and they would go up to $480,000. That's separate from the immediate relatives category, which is a spouse, minor child, or parent of a U.S. citizen. Now, looking at legalization, there's basically three categories of folks under the Senate bill that you need to look at. One is people here more than 5 years. Those people, if they were able to go through the various hoops, I guess you'd call them, in terms of future work and taxes and English language requirement, they would immigrate or become legal immigrants without quota. In other words, they don't fall under the numerical caps. The people here 2 to 5 years, who in addition to the different hoops would actually have to leave the country and come back in, they would fall under the employment caps. And those here less than 2 years, there's no particular benefit for them under the bill. Now, I'm not going to go through all the calculations, but we basically relied on the Congressional Budget Office estimates about what is the approximate breakdown of these 5 year plus and 2 to 5 year categories for who would finally get permanent residence. And the reason for relying on that is that it was just basically seemed like a very reasonable set of estimates for that. And then that total also includes the on legalization. If you look at that total, it also includes their dependents for the principal immigrants, in other words, the spouse or children. There's another form of legalization in the bill, which is called blue card agricultural workers, and they have a separate set of requirements. And we also used primarily the CBO estimate on that. That gives us our number there that you can see. And those people have future work requirements in terms of having to work a certain number of years in agriculture over the next 3 to 5 years to be able to finally get a green card in that category. They are also outside of the quota. The future temporary workers, would anyone who comes in on H-2C would be within the employment-based quotas. Finally, looking at there is a catch-all of other legal immigrants to try to take care of people who might have fall outside of the earlier analysis of the categories. And without going into great detail, just to point out that there are some exemptions in the employment-based categories where people would come in outside of the numerical limit. Those are for the most high-skilled, people who've got a graduate degree, for example, from a U.S. university. In addition, there's an estimate of additional immediate relatives of U.S. citizens that's assumed because you would have people who would become naturalized citizens some years after the bill is introduced, and presumably having more of them would result in somewhat increase in the immediate relatives category. So the bottom line here is that that these numbers are I think a fair estimate. There are a few caveats, I would say, that could change estimates in the future because of the uncertainties. And by the way, for those who came late, again, the website that we're following that has the study is www.nfap.com, nfap.com, and the study's right on top there. Two of the uncertainties are, one is that the immediate relatives category I just mentioned, we posit about 50,000 a year starting in the after 5 years after the bill is passed. And again, that certainly could be more than that. It's based on things that we just can't know at this time, such as forecasting future marriages. Another area that could be an underestimate is looking at the dependence per principal immigrant. Everyone who's been looking at this has used the 1.2 dependence per principal because that's been the history. But it's certainly possible that people who have been here a long time, for example, some of them, when you average it out over the course of the years, that it could come out to somewhat more than 1.2 dependents per principal. So to wrap this up before I turn over to Tamar, to mention some of the points again at the beginning, that there are reasons why the bill is structured the way it was, which is to get at both the family and employment-based backlogs, but also to try to have a more regularized flow of people into the country coming in legally versus illegally, and then having some opportunity as part of a political compromise for people who are already here in the country, that they would have a chance to regularize their status. And as pointed out, many of these people would already be in the country. And finally, on that last point, again, I think that it is a fair point to look at, that this 200,000 limit that they put on the temporary worker category may simply just be too low to achieve some of the purposes that the sponsors intended. At that, I'm going to turn it over to Tamar. Tamar?
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you for including me in this conversation. I'm just going to say I'm a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and this is the NFAP study. I think it's an important study, and I'm just going to comment very briefly and put it in a little bit of context. I think it is an important study because this numbers debate is already having a significant influence on what Congress is doing. Many of you have been following it know that two significant amendments to the Senate bill, both proposed by Senator Bingaman of New Mexico, reduced the numbers, both the numbers on the temporary worker program and the number of green cards ultimately, significant reductions that were driven in large part, or certainly this numbers debate was cited as part of the political pressure and rationale for reducing those numbers. So this numbers debate is going to be central, and I think going to be perhaps more central as we go into conference. So this is an important the study comes in on one side of an important argument here. I also think that it's a rigorous but appealingly sort of realistic and modest study. I like the way the NFAP has, for example, been skeptical about knowing how are we going to know how people are going to how many people are going to get married or not get married, or how many dependents they'll bring. I think it's a hard, rigorous, clear-eyed look at the legislation and the numbers. This is not some sort of cooking of the books. To step back a little bit and talk a minute about the context, and to underscore some of what Stuart said, I think the most important thing to understand is that this legislation was never meant to increase the overall flow of immigrants into the United States. The primary goal of this legislation is to take the flow that's now coming illegally and is bad for the country because of the illegality, the under eroding of the rule of law and the undermining of our security because of the illegality, to take that illegal flow and give those people a way to come legally so that we can have the benefits of the immigration without the consequences of the illegality. And that's to to say that that shift from the illegal to legal column, which is, again, the primary goal, one of the primary goals of the legislation, to say that that's an increase in the numbers, I think is wrong and disingenuous. This applies also to the illegal population already here. One of the ideas behind the legislation is that we can't have a legal, orderly, airtight, controlled immigration system if we build it on top of a population the size of an illegal population, the size of Pennsylvania or Ohio, living in the shadows. So we need to figure out, for our sake, some way for those people to come in out of the shadows, make restitution and jump through whatever hoops, but get onto the right side of the law, to count them as people who are peddling these very high numbers, suggest to count them as new immigrants. Is, again, it's hard to know, how do you say, somewhere the line between wrong and just out and out disingenuous. Yet another goal of the bill, to reduce the backlogs of people waiting to come to this country. People who already have a right under the law, siblings of citizens, for example, to come to this country, we've already decided long ago that those people have a right to come to America and be Americans. They now sometimes have to wait between 10 and 20 years or more in some cases, because our quotas, which are slightly different than the right, we have a quota system that doesn't keep up with what we've already decided are people's rights. Because the quotas are too small, we don't allow people to exercise the rights that our law already gives them. And so siblings of family members wait 10 and 20 years. To say that that's an increase in the numbers, I would argue, is also disingenuous. We've already given those people a right to come to this country. So I think it's important to look at the intent of the legislation and put that next to some of these exaggerated threats about the numbers, and I think that gives the National Foundation more sober estimate of the numbers, puts it in a different context. The last thing I'd just like to comment very briefly is it's important to understand the link between numbers and effective enforcement. Having numbers that are too low, that are out of sync with our labor needs and the market equilibrium that is generated by those labor needs. If our quotas are too low and so out of sync with those labor needs, we are never going to be able to enforce our immigration law. The president said it in his speech today. He said unless we create real channels, legal channels, for those people who are coming here to work, walls and men are not going to stop the flow. And the analogy is prohibition. As long as you have unrealistic, unenforceable law, it's extremely difficult to make it stick. And the point of this reform is to replace unrealistic, unenforceable law with realistic law that we then enforce in a serious way, like we mean it. And if you're not realistic about the numbers coming, you're not going to get that enforcement dividend. And so a disingenuous debate that drives down the numbers in the legislation and means we don't admit the number that would allow us to keep up with supply and demand and our labor needs means it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to make the enforcement that's in the law stick. And it will be 1986 all over again, where we don't own up to our labor needs, we don't create ways for those people to come to work, and as a result, our enforcement doesn't really stick. So in the long run, people arguing these disingenuous estimates of the numbers are going to undermine the very goal of the people who are peddling those estimates, I presume, which is to restore the rule of law. So, I think the National Foundation more realistic assessments of the numbers is a real service to this debate and to the larger goal of the legislation.
Thank you, Tamar. And I guess I'll throw back for a second to our operator, Alan, to tell everyone how we go about the question-answer period.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. The question-and-answer session will be conducted electronically. If you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, please press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause a moment to assemble our queue. And we'll take our first question from Bill McKenzie with the Dallas Morning News.
Could one of you all explain again what the Bingham Amendment does on terms of employment-based immigration? I'm a little lost there.
Sure, I can take a first crack at it, and Tamar, you can jump in. there's basically two different amendments. One took what was on the temporary visas, in other words, the flow of new people coming into the country for on a temporary for temporary periods, I believe 3 to 6 years. He took what was at $325,000 a year, and it also had a provision that if the cap was hit in a particular year, to avoid huge backlogs in the category, it would be able to go up in a future year or the next year, I believe, up to 20%. And a second Bingaman amendment would say, okay, on this green card side, which are for folks who are able to stay here permanently, those we will cap overall at $650,000 a year, regardless of any other quotas you might have that would, for example, be exempting the spouses and minor children from being counted, which in theory at least, or likely in practice in the first 10 years, would end up taking you over that $650,000 number, particularly because the folks in the 2 to 5 year category who are here illegally 2 to 5 years get funneled through that system, you know, those quotas. So those are the two different Bingaman amendments.
So the $650,000 would include the worker and their dependents?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't add to that. I mean, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Unless you're further confused and want to elaborate the question.
I think they got it. Thank you, Barr.
And we'll go next to Carolyn Lockhead with the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yes, hi. How are you? Do either of you have any updated information on when the conference committee is going to start? I'm hearing there's a hitch over in the Senate, and I haven't seen any moves by House to name conferees.
Yeah, I mean, my take on that, there was this hitch in the Senate where because there's a tax issue raised by the earned income tax credit, this is now technically a tax bill. And the tax bills have a different route to conference than non-tax bills. And I guess it was somebody held it up on that because of that. And so it's being held hostage for the moment. Frist had hoped to announce the Senate conferees last Friday and wasn't able to, and is waiting for that. I think, you know, in the larger picture, that's the technicality. The larger picture is, you know, we're seeing in the last 5 days, you know, mostly on the airwaves, are the first volleys of what I think is going to be, you know, a long, somewhat public and somewhat private negotiation between the Senate, the White House, and the House about what the eventual legislation looks like. And, you know, Representative Sensenbrenner has launched his first salvos on the airwaves, and I don't think those are going to be his last words. But I think, as in any negotiation, those first rounds of discussion sometimes have to get out of the way, you know, be gotten through and gotten out of the way before people get down to more serious conversation. I think that's what's happening now. And so I don't think it's so much on a schedule that has to do with you know, exactly when legislatively things can come up as that some of that air clearing has to happen. And, you know, the president answered with his speech this morning, and they'll go from here. And for those of you who didn't, in case anyone didn't hear the president's speech, you know, he said in very clear terms, there are some in Congress who think that in order for any legalization measure not to be amnesty, everyone will have to leave the country. And he said, I understand they're well intended, but they're unrealistic and they're wrong. So, you know, I think he answered Representative Hastert very clearly. Hastert saying, you know, anything that takes care of those people is amnesty. The president said, I don't think so.
And one other thing, you're referring to the Heritage numbers, right?
Yeah, if you look at our study.
When Tamar was calling some of these efforts disingenuous.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I mean, the Heritage and then, you know, Senator Sessions' use of them.
And we'll go next to Deborah Bulkley with the Deseret Morning News.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I'd like to just ask real quick, have you looked at all about, you know, streamlining these efforts to make employers more likely to go through, to, you know, to actually apply for these visas for people? Especially on some of these visas that may not that may not be used as widely as they could be used under the current law?
That's a really good point. There are basically two categories that have potential to do some of what the Senate bill is trying to accomplish through new legislation. One is called H-2B, which is rather, it's been interpreted rather in a limited fashion, particularly by the Department of Labor, to only allow seasonal workers to be able to come in non-agricultural jobs and only for temporary periods that generally are much less than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only limited to 66,000. And interestingly, to kind of echoes one of Tamar's points, is that even with all the limitations and all the bureaucracy and the numerical limitations and everything that go into that, those all still get used up. They've been used up the last few years. For agriculture, H-2A, interestingly, there's actually no numerical limit. People don't realize this, but there's no numerical limit on the number of agricultural guest workers that could come into the country. The problem is because it's a rather bureaucratic process for the employers, and also it's a lot of employers, quite frankly, get sued quite often whenever they start to hire anyone under these provisions. That it's not used very much in comparison. I mean, it's been tended to be around 30-something thousand a year in comparison to probably, we're looking at hundreds of thousands of people who are here illegally working in agriculture.
The one thing I would add to that is to talk a little bit about H-1B program.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the point about this legislation and part of exactly the point that this numbers debate is getting at is that a lot of people, H-1B is a temporary kind of visa for skilled workers, and people now who fully intend to come to this country to stay and live and, be nuclear scientists here and invent computer chips here and, do all kinds of things that we desperately want people to do, there aren't enough green cards for them, so they come on a temporary worker program and then try to figure out ways to stay. And that's exactly what's wrong with the system and why one of the key reasons why there is an increase in green cards in this legislation is that so those people who we want don't have to come on a temporary worker program that isn't really suited to who they are and what their needs are and what we'd like to have happen to them. And again, to have a numbers debate, the principal goal of which is to reduce the number of green cards is so, in that case, cutting off our nose to spite our face. I mean, let's cut off the number of green cards for nuclear scientists and engineers and skilled, physics people with advanced physics degree who can make our computer industry the envy of the world. I mean, that's a really good idea.
I would say, by the way, right underneath, if you're looking at our website, again, it's www.nfap.com. Underneath that, there's a study called Waiting Forever, which we released last week, that goes into the different backlogs and waiting times, and hopefully an easy-to-understand chart that goes into how long the waits are for the different family and employment-based categories.
But would this make it easier for employers to petition for employees, like, for example, the agricultural visa that isn't used? I mean, would there be any – I'm just wondering what would be different about the process that the employer has to go through that would make them more likely to petition for their workers to get these visas?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. On the blue card program, which has gotten much less attention,
mm-hmm.
there's actually a very elaborate compromise that has been worked out between the farm labor advocates and employers that is designed to make it easier to use and to also have worker protections, but to make it much easier to use than it is now. It's part of a carefully negotiated compromise over many, many years. When I was working in the Senate, we had, I think, at least three hearings just on the agricultural worker issue, because it was a type of issue that was always close to getting a compromise but never quite achieved it. And so now they have one, and that was included in this bill.
Okay. Thanks.
And once again, if you'd like to ask a question, it's star one at this time, and we'll go next to Pilar Marrero with the Opinion newspaper.
Hey, hi, from La Opinion. What would be then an appropriate number of employment visas or temporary work visas that would take care of the needs of the country?
Well, I mean, what the Senate legislation initially had in it before the Bingaman Amendment was 400,000 a year with a cap
and this was the important thing, a cap, or an escalator, in effect, or a de-escalator, so that if in times of low unemployment, where we needed more workers, that number could go up somewhat, the 400,000. In times of high unemployment, when we didn't need so many, that number could go down somewhat. And that the idea of that escalator, de-escalator, was to keep the flow, again, in line with our labor needs. You know, the government doesn't decide how many people we need in the economy. I mean, that's what they tried in the Soviet Union. In America, supply and demand decides how many workers we need in the economy. And so the ideal situation with immigration law is to have the quotas be flexibly in link with that flow that's generated by supply and demand. And 400,000 with a escalator, de-escalator, wasn't a bad place to start. In recent years, the number coming in excess of our quotas, and most of them do come to work, has been somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000.
Thank you.
And we'll go next to Sharon McNary with Press Enterprise.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. Talking about the Rector study, the Heritage study, can you describe the chief shortcomings of that study that makes it a disingenuous study?
Well, I didn't use the term disingenuous, so I say, look, I think everyone's trying to do this in good faith. I just think there are shortcomings. So but it is a good question, and I didn't get a chance to cover it earlier. I think really one place where the biggest number difference becomes is that what both Senator Sessions and Robert Rector were doing is anyone who came in on a temporary visa, they were counting as a permanent legal immigrant. I'm talking about anyone even in the future coming in on a temporary visa. And, you know, the fact is the way the bill is designed is that any of those people, if you were to stay here permanently, you'd have to be generally sponsored and get a green card through the employment-based system, and that has its own set of numerical caps. So they would, so anyone who stays here permanently would get counted under that cap. In addition, some of the very large estimates when people were throwing around $200 million came from not only failing to count them under the green card cap, but were making these assumptions based on, when Tamar was mentioning this escalator provision, they were saying, well, what if we had that temporary cap got hit every year, and then 20% on top of that came in every year, and eventually you were getting up to, like 20 million people a year coming in theory, under the legislation is the way they were arguing it, and that obviously was, unlikely to be happening. So that was probably the biggest. That's probably the biggest difference is A, not counting the temporary workers as permanent unless they came in through the green card quotas, and B, this idea of having this large escalator and making assumptions of like 20 million a year possibly coming in these under the earlier provisions of the Senate bill.
And just to I won't add anything to that. That's hits the nail on the head. Disingenuous is my word, and I'm me, and Stuart is Stuart, and that's why we have two people talking.
Thank you.
And once again, if you'd like to ask a question, it's star one, and we'll go next to Rita Gerona Atkins with the Philippine News.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, I have a quick question. If we can get back to the reunification of families component. Those have been waiting in the pipeline for as long as 20-some years. Now, there is an amendment, the ACACA amendment, Senate number amendment 2049, which would allow relatives of the Filipino World War II veterans who had become naturalized here in the United States, but when they came here, their families were not allowed to come here other than to wait into the numerical category of family reunification, which, as you said, it takes about 20-some years. Now, apparently this bill, this amendment, which had passed, which was passed on a floor vote at the Senate, is still part of the, it made it in the 2611 immigration bill. And my question is that, do you think, since that is outside of the numerical categories, Do you think that that would raise some problem regarding? There are probably something like the families of about 24,000 old men. They're on the average of about 70 to 80 years old, and probably some of their children are. The amendment apparently would allow their single or married children and their grandchildren who are 21 and below, age 21 and below, to come here. But, of course, their families are already, I mean, they are, most of them are in the Philippines, although there are probably about, oh, something like about, probably about 15,000 of them here living in the United States as naturalized citizens and still waiting and waiting and waiting for their families to come and join them.
I saw that the amendment passed. I'm familiar with it, but, you know, it's really hard to predict anything, I would say, on something like that, because it gets into such a narrow thing. I mean, I think that type of thing, that type of amendment would somewhat depend on how active the sponsor is in trying to, you know, get someone to be fighting for it in the conference. In the scheme of things, with some of the numbers that, particularly some of the estimates that have been made, you know, earlier than our study, you know, it certainly will not seem like a large number of people in the context. So I think this is one of these examples of a smaller provision that it somewhat depends on how skillfully the chief sponsor would position him.
Apparently it has the support of McCain and Kennedy in the original comprehensive immigration bill, and, of course, the Asian Pacific American Caucus and et cetera, and probably, I don't know if the Philippine government through the Philippine embassy, because that's been their focus as well. But it apparently has a strong support, at least in the Senate, the fact that it made it, you know, surprisingly, it made it on the floor vote without much problem, and it made it right to the past 2611 bill.
Well, again, this will be something we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you much.
And we'll take our last question from Tom Brune with Newsday.
Hi. Thanks for taking the question. I'm very interested in what those who back the Senate bill are willing to give up to reach some kind of compromise with the House. Is there any chance of including a guest worker or temporary worker program without any kind of sort of path to citizenship? Is this a realistic possibility?
That wouldn't work. You know, if the promise of reform, not just to pass a bunch of different provisions on immigration, the promise of reform is to, again, have the immigration that's good for the country without the illegality that currently comes with it. And the way you do that, there you need a package with three moving parts. The first two are laws more in line with our labor needs that you then enforce like we mean it. Instead of the current nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you go to a system where the laws are realistic and we do enforce them. But it's hard to build that kind of new airtight structure on top of an illegal population of 12 million people. I mean, I think, you know, anyone following this debate, you know, on TV or whatever, the American public understands that you can't solve the problem of illegal immigration without taking care of that illegal immigrant waiting down in the parking lot at the
Home Depot. Maybe anybody watching it may understand that as you propose here, but certainly there seem to be several House members who don't buy that argument at all.
I don't think it would ever pass the Senate, a bill without a without provisions for the 12 million people.
So how rigid is this opposition in the House, you think?
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, that's a $54 million question. We could call it the $12 million question.
The 12 million person question.
I believe that the public wants a solution, and the president wants a solution, and a strong bipartisan majority in the Senate want a solution. And, you know, the House does seem very dug in, but we're only at the beginning of, again, what I believe will be a long back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Alan, is there anyone else waiting for questions?
That's all we have.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you. Before I close, Tamara, do you have any other points you'd like to make?
No, thanks for including me.
Okay. Well, thank you for being there. Our website, if you haven't, if you joined late, is www.nfap.com. And you can also, if you want to reach me later for a follow-up, you can call 703-351-3000. 5042, 703-351-5042. And Tamara, do you want to leave a number?
I urge everyone to call you
if
they want to talk about the study. But in case people want to follow up with me on something I said, I'm at 973-744-6117.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for participating.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's call. Thank you for your participation, and you may disconnect at this time.